Well, api certainly bhutanam living entities, harihi, the Lord who mitigates all the miseries of the living entities. Atma, the original source of life. Ishvara, the complete controller. Priya, the deer. Bhutai, by the separated energies, the five material elements. Madbihi, emanating from the total material energy. The Mahatattva. Svakritai, which are manifested by himself. Kritanam, created. Jiva-saṅgitaḥ, who is also known as the living entity, since the living entities are expansions of his marginal energy. Translation: the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, is the soul and the supersoul of all living entities. Every living entity is a manifestation of his energy in terms of the living soul and the material body. Therefore, the Lord is the most dear, and he is the supreme controller. Purport: the Supreme Personality of Godhead is manifested by his different energies, the material energy, the spiritual energy, and the marginal energy. He is the original source of all living entities in the material world, and he is situated in everyone's heart as the supersoul. Although the living entity is the cause of his various types of bodies, the body is given by material nature according to the order of the Lord. Ishvara sarva bhutanam hridayeshu juna tishtati pramayan sarva bhutani yantra rudhani mayaya. The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, O Arjuna, and is directing the wanderings of all living entities who are seated as on a machine made of the material energy. The body is just like a machine, a car, in which the living entity is given a chance to sit and move according to his desire. The Lord is the original cause of the material body and the soul, which is expanded by his marginal energy. The Supreme Lord is the dearmost object of all living entities. Prahlad Maharaj therefore advised his class friends, the sons of the demons, to take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead again. Okay, I'll just read text 50. Devo suro manushyo va yaksho gandharva eva va bhajan mukunda charanam svastimam man syanyata vayam. If a demigod, a demon, human being, yaksha, gandharva, or anyone within this universe renders service to the lotus feet of Mukunda, who can deliver liberation, he is actually situated in the most auspicious condition of life, exactly like us, the Mahajans headed by Prahlad Maharaj. Purport: Prahlad Maharaj, by his living example, requested his friends to engage in devotional service, whether in demigod society, asura society, human society, or Gandharva society. Every living entity should take shelter of the lotus feet of Mukunda and thus become perfect in good fortune. Okay, so here Prahlad Maharaj is continuing to try to persuade his friends, to worship Hari, the Supreme Lord. So here in these two verses, he's giving four arguments. So first argument is that God is the soul and the super soul of all living entities. Second argument is that the Lord is most dear to us. Third one is that you can, anybody can do it. You know, there's, it doesn't matter where you are in life, anybody can do it. And if you do it, auspiciousness will come your way. You'll get auspiciousness. So anyways, just giving it whole, like this whole thing is just argument after argument why you should take shelter of Hari, surrender to Hari. So if we start with the first argument, interesting claims being made here. Here, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, is the soul and the super soul. So, anyway, we just heard a pretty awesome class for Radhastami, where this topic was addressed in nice length and depth. So I might repeat some of these points that were made about how Hari is the soul. Here the Sanskrit word jiva samgitaha. So jivas, the soul, you know, the soul, us, and then samgitaha. Here it's being translated, who is also known as the living entity. So Hari is also known as the living entity. Hari is identified as being the living entity. So, you know, this kind of sounds... Anyway, so we heard some nice explanations about this, how the Lord is actually one with the soul in certain respects, and the Lord is also different from the soul in certain respects. So there's three ways. I know, every time I give a class, all I do is just give lists of things. That's how I think, is just lists. So Hari is the soul. There's three ways to understand that. Or, I mean, there's probably more, but at least three that we heard during Radhastami, which are kind of nice. So the Hari is the soul. So in order to understand that Hari is the soul, first, it's important to understand who the soul is, who we are. So in order to understand God, first, it's helpful to understand who we are. You know, here we hear that self-realization, it's pretty much synonymous with God-realization, because God is just like us. So if we understand who we are, we can understand what God is like. So it's one way in which we can understand how Hari is the soul. The second way of understanding how Hari is the soul is when we're referring to Krishna or Lord, we're referring to a tattva. So tattva means reality. And then when we're speaking about Krishna, we're referring to a tattva. And then in the Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 2, text 11, this tattva of the absolute truth is described as being jnanam advaya. So we heard this too. So jnanam is translated as, can be translated as either knowledge, or it can be translated as the knower, subject of knowledge. So jnanam is, the knower is also known as consciousness. So jnanam, the tattvam, the Krishna is consciousness, and who's also advaya. Advaya means that which is not separated from anything else. It's intimately connected with everything else. And not only is it intimately connected with everything and everyone else, but it's also the root from which everything else and everyone else comes. So that's what this consciousness of Krishna is. That's the reality. So when we're referring to Hari as being the soul, Hari is that consciousness from which everything comes, the root of all consciousness, the root of everything, everything is in that consciousness. So it follows then that you can say that Hari is the soul. That's another way of understanding that Hari is the soul. Yeah. So the third way, interesting third way, more kind of a cool way to think about it, is that in order to understand how Hari is the soul, it first helps to understand how Krishna and Radharani are the same. So here the text says Hari is the soul. They're identified as the same jiva samgitaha. So Krishna and the soul have like a kind of a common identity. But in order to understand that common identity, it helps to understand the original common identity between Radha and Krishna. So we hear that Radha and Krishna, they're described as ekatmanaha. So one identity. Atma means identity. So one identity. You know, Radharani is described as Krishna's love. So how can you separate Krishna's love from Krishna? So the example is given that Radharani is like the sunshine and Krishna is like the sun. How can you separate the sunshine from the sun? They're like one identity. So in other words, you can say that Radharani is like a facet of Krishna, just like sunshine is a facet of the sun. So that's understanding the original Krishna and his energies. So then what happens is when Krishna expands as, like, let's say Narayan, and then Radharani then also expands with Krishna's expansions as personalities to kind of be with Krishna's expansion. So Krishna expands as Narayan, Radharani expands as Lakshmi, you know, and then Narayan expands as Vishnu, Lakshmi expands as another form of Lakshmi, and then anyway, it goes down the line all the way till you get to the expansion of Vishnu expanding as Paramatma. And then when Vishnu expands as Paramatma, Radharani, her expansions expand to the living entities. So Paramatma and Atma. So that's the relationship there. So if we understand how Krishna is more or less the same as Radharani, so then Krishna's expansions are more or less the same as Radharani's expansions, and we, the jivas, are more or less expansions of Radharani. So you see how that's connected again? You know, or Krishna, and Krishna is the soul in that sense. So there's three interesting senses to understand this statement, which we heard from recently, which were kind of cool. So then, during this class, Justin asked a nice question. He asked, you know, so if we hear this, generally we hear a lot about the stress between the difference between God and us. So there's this emphasis on the difference aspect, but there's also this oneness aspect, which is also important. So when does the oneness aspect become more relevant and important? So anyway, we heard a nice explanation that, well, they're both important aspects to understand of the absolute truth, the oneness and the difference aspect. And generally, if one has like an imbalance in those conceptions, like he thinks too much of the oneness between God and everything and everyone, then we might preach in a certain way to try to bring about the importance of the difference between God and us. But if someone is super stressing on just the difference, then we might highlight the importance of the oneness between God and us. So that way there's like a balance, so it's level. Because it is important to be understand the oneness aspect of everything between God and the living entities and everything, because it was nicely described that in order to be able to have a deep, loving relationship with somebody, you have to have things in common with them. So that was a nice explanation. You have to have things in common with someone if you want to have a deep, loving relationship with someone. So if you are going to go out and fall in love with somebody, most likely it's going to be a human being. You're not going to go out and fall in love with an insect, or you know, something, because it's hard to relate with an insect. You have very little in common with an insect. But you know, so you might be able to relate more with a dog. These are the examples that were given. You might be able to relate more with a dog because, you know, they're a little bit more like you. They got eyes and nose and, you know, a little more facial features similar to ours. And you might even be able to relate more with a monkey because they're even closer to us. Might have a deeper relationship with the monkey. But then if you really want, like, the deepest, deeper relationship, you would relate with somebody who is of more in common with you, namely a human being. So that same principle applies with the absolute truth. If we are going to develop a deep loving relationship with Krishna, then we need to have a lot in common with Krishna to be able to have that deep loving relationship. So not only are we a lot like Krishna, but Krishna is actually the root of our consciousness. He's the ground from which all the consciousness spring up. So who can be more intimately connected or united with us than Krishna, because he's the root of our consciousness. So that shows how deep of an relationship that we can have. So these are a little cap summary of that Radharani Katha class, at least as it relates with this verse. Here, the second reason that Prahlad Maharaj mentions is that the Lord is the most dear to the living entities. So he's the most dear object. So in the purport, the Supreme Lord is the dearmost object of all living entities. So what makes somebody or someone dearmost to you? What makes somebody or someone dearmost to you? So we have desires. We are consciousness. We are the soul, and we have desires. So one who can be considered dearmost to us is one who can satisfy our desires that are considered dearmost. So then the question is, what are our desires? What do we want? What do you want? And then not just like what you need or what you require for practically going about your day, but what is it that you really, really want? And why is it that you want that? And what is the deeper want behind that want? And, you know, you keep going down to, like, the deepest want. Anyway, for those of you who heard that class, I felt that that class really related with this verse, so I'm connecting that class with this verse. So then you'll know that the deepest want of all living entities, of all consciousness, is... Anyone remember? Happiness. Yeah, duh. No, duh. So everybody wants happiness. And so then if we are consciousness, how can consciousness, or, you know, we're a conscious living entity, how can us as conscious living entities be happy? So how can we fulfill our desires as conscious living entities? So as consciousness. So consciousness, we hear, it requires an object to be conscious of. So that's another, how else is the conscious living entity going to be happy unless he has an object to be conscious of? So then that object, that living entity is looking for an object which can completely fulfill all of his desires. So that's so finding that object which can completely fulfill all our desires that will make us happy. So then what is that object that will completely fulfill all the desires of the conscious living entity? Krishna. Krishna is that object. So here, Supreme Lord is the dearmost object of the living entities. So just as we as consciousness have that desire, have desires, and we want to fulfill those desires, and the way we fulfill those desires is through connecting, being conscious of something, having an object to which our consciousness can be conscious of, the same principle applies with Krishna. Krishna has desires. He has desires, and he wants to be conscious of something. And being conscious of something makes Krishna happy, or, you know, expand his unlimited happiness. So who is that object for the Supreme Lord's consciousness? Who? We are. In a sense, we are. But in a better sense, it's who or what? Srimati Radharani. Srimati Radharani, she's the most beautiful. She's actually, you know, Krishna's internal beauty, Krishna's love. So who's more attractive than that? So then we heard in the same class that there's this beautiful reciprocal symbiotic relationship between the subject of consciousness and the object of consciousness. So the idea is that the subject of consciousness wants an object to be conscious of, but the way this existence works is that the objects which are, emanating or expanding from Krishna, they're also subjects in and of themselves. So they're like subjects that are objects. No, they're objects that are subjects. They're objects meant for Krishna's pleasure, but they're also subjects in of themselves. So what makes these subject-object category type is that what makes them happy is that they want to be objects of someone else's consciousness or of another person's consciousness. So consciousness needs an object to be conscious of, and the object needs consciousness. That's what we heard. And it's a nice way to think about it. Because generally when we think of objects, we think of something inert, like a table, a hammer, something which doesn't have consciousness. But the consciousness that, you know, we are also objects in a sense, almost like a hammer and a table. But we have consciousness, but we're also subjects too. And so the idea is that we want to be the object of somebody's, of Krishna's consciousness ultimately. And that'll make us happy. Because we don't want something boring to be conscious of, like a drywall or just like a light or something. We want the best, most beautiful thing to be conscious of. So that's Krishna. He also wants the best, most beautiful thing to be conscious of. And that's Radharani. So, okay. So is there any discussion on these points? Jordan.
Hare Krishna. So since Krishna is all attractive and Krishna is attracted to Radharani, wouldn't Radharani be the most attractive object?
You're asking is because Krishna is attracted to Radharani, would that make Radharani the most attractive object?
Yeah, and the second part, then wouldn't we be more attracted to Radharani than Krishna.
Wouldn't we be more attracted to Radharani?
Yeah.
Well, we're subjects. We're the objects. We're expansions of Radharani, and Radharani is like the supreme, most attractive object for Krishna's consciousness. And because we're expansion, and what Radharani wants is that she wants to be looked at by Krishna. She wants Krishna to be attracted to her. That's how you know, that's the whole masculine femininity nature, is that men generally like to be attracted and women like to be looked at, like to have the attraction come their way. So that same principle is there in Radha and Krishna. So Radharani, she is the most attractive and she likes to attract the consciousness of Krishna. So yes, she is most attractive in the sense that she attracts the most attractive, who is Krishna. But because we are, in one sense, expansions of Radharani, how we get attracted to, in our original constitutional state, we don't get attracted necessarily so much to the we're attracted to Krishna. By our constitutional nature, we, as being objects for Krishna's pleasure, we are attracted by Krishna's getting pleasure from us. That's what gives us pleasure. And that's what makes us attracted to Krishna. We are attracted to... So it's not that we get attracted to... in the sense that Radharani and Krishna are the same and then they're one, yeah, we get attracted. But in the sense of us as being expansions of Radharani, we are attracted to Krishna looking at us. Does that make sense? Did I explain that kind of coherently? Justin?
I was just thinking on this point of subject-object, we like are imposing our own gross understanding of subject-object, because in that realm, everything is pure subjectivity. There's no difference between your body and your consciousness. So it's not like by looking at, you're objectifying. You know, there is no objectivity in that, in a sense. You know, we're in the material world, everyone is an object, and that gets in the way of real reciprocation and love.
Yeah, everybody is a subject. Everybody is consciousness. Yeah. Consciousness means you're a subject. It means that you can be aware of something. You are a subject. But that consciousness is also an object for Krishna, Krishna's pleasure. So it's really weird to think. It's hard to like use these terms.
Right. Like, because in this plane, there's a dichotomy between one's subjectivity and one's objectivity.
Yeah, that's right, true.
So when I receive Dan's body, I might misinterpret that. It like creates, you know, a misinterpretation. Right?
Yeah. Of course, we also heard that everything is also in consciousness. So we heard that you know, consciousness itself is in consciousness. Obviously, it's in that realm of complete subjectivity, I guess, subject realm. But then all the like the ahankar, the buddhi, all the elements that, you know, come from there, they're also in the realm of consciousness. So let's wrap your mind around that. So. But nevertheless, your point still stands that here we have this dichotomy between objects and the subjects, whereas in the spiritual realm, there isn't so much that dichotomy. Although we do remain our individual identity, we do have always our individuals. So in one sense, there will always be like a sense of being an object, because Krishna is the original person, the original Purusha. And his identity is different also than us. So he will always be the supreme subject, and we will always be an object, even though we are little subjects in of ourselves.
But there's no difference between us and our form. Like, we are, our form is, our swarup is us, you know. Whereas
right.
In the material world, there's the physical form, which is different than...
Right, so yeah, that's true. Yeah, in the spiritual world, the form we have and who we are, it's the same. Here, the form we have and who we are is different. So we're thinking of this body as it's like an object. It's almost like an object of the soul in a sense. It's like you know, here we give the example of a car. You know, the body is like a car and we're the soul. So just, or the person who drives the car is like an object for that person. So similarly, the body is like an object for the soul. And so similarly, the soul is like an object for Krishna. So you see how that works, the evolving understanding of subjects and objects. Okay, anything, any other discussion? Alex.
So Prabhu, you said to fall in love with someone, I mean, we fell in love with those who are like us, right? Mm-hmm. Dog, monkey, whatever. So I see that this is kind of based more on the platform of our ego, because it's like me, right? This is I.
Right, that was just a crude example to give you an understanding how you can really only have a deep relationship with someone who has things in common with you. So I just gave the example of falling in love in like this material world. So generally people fall in love with human beings and they can have a deep relationship. But ultimately we're meant to love Krishna. And then the thing is, Krishna and us has the most in common. We're most like Krishna than anybody else. So that's all I meant to say. It's not a perfect analogy because, yeah, like you said, that it's most, falling in love mostly has to do with our conditioned nature, who we're attracted to, who we're not. But on the soul level, we're attracted to Krishna because he's most like us. He has the most in common with us. Anything else? Okay. Well, I'll end here. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Were you there for...